has gone rocketing by, and we're almost ready for 2023. And while most of the news we hear these days is pretty grim, and most of the stories we bring you don't have happy endings, we want to look at the other side of the coin. This week, we look at life sunny side up. We delve into the progress being made on issues of concern. We talk to people who are part of the solution, and we take a moment to embrace all the positives because there's a lot out there to be positive about. Fox 11 News in Depth starts right now. Hello, everyone. I'm Hal Eisner. Let's start literally from the ground up. California has new laws this year regulating organic waste disposal. And in January, we looked into just what happens when you throw your waste into those green bins and what a huge difference it makes. It's hard to believe, but a solution to climate change could start with a single apple peel.
This is really a very exciting. Compost is one of my favorite things to talk about, which is probably why I have the job that I have. Compost is really broken down organic materials. So our leaves, our grass, our other yard waste and food materials like that apple core you showed in your video, eggshells, breadcrumbs, broken down into what is turns out to be a soil amendment. So when we put compost, we build compost and then we put it on the soil and we mix it with the dirt in the soil. It becomes fertilizer for our parks and for our crops.
Now, you know, people at home may be scratching their heads. I mean, we already have cans for waste, cans for recycling. What's going to happen now? Are we going to have cans for composting?
So in some jurisdictions, at least half of the jurisdictions here in California across the state, most of us already have a green bin in one shape or another. So many jurisdictions had it started a few years back for our yard waste, which was being turned into compost. And a lot of jurisdictions are simply going to expand that for your food waste as well and send it to facilities that can take in that food waste and turn it into compost as well.
So we talk about Senate Bill 1383. This is the bill that went into effect January 1st, as we all have to be composting now. What's your reaction to that bill? What do you think about it? How do you think it's going to be implemented over the next year or two?
That legislation was passed in 2016 and was really groundbreaking and led the nation in policy around super climate pollutants. As you mentioned before, methane is 84 times more potent than carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. And this legislation aims to curb or eliminate California's methane emissions almost entirely. So I think, you know, Californians are determined to fight climate change. And this is the fastest and simplest way that each and every one of us can be a part of the climate fight. If I just take that banana peel, that apple core, those eggshells, and I put it in my organic waste as opposed to throwing it in the garbage can, that is so much easier than me getting out of my car. When we reach our 75% goal here in a few years of removal of organic waste from landfills, it's the same as taking over 1 million cars off the road for a year. So this is groundbreaking. Wow,
just explain. Okay, I need you to explain something to me. You talk about the banana peel here or the apple core there, but how does this affect the greenhouse gases? How does this affect global warming?
So methane, let's take a step back. When we throw that apple core and that banana peel in our garbage can right now, what it does is it goes to a landfill and that it breaks down into methane. That methane is really, really potent in our atmosphere. It is warming the climate at an incredibly high rate. So when we take it out of the landfill and we put it into a different type of environment where it breaks down into compost, it not only isn't creating that methane, that super pollutant, it is turning into a soil amendment that can capture climate pollution. It can sequester carbon from the atmosphere. So we're taking a problem and we're turning it into a solution.
A couple of months later, we examined another big step forward in our battle against climate change and the increasing cost for fossil fuels, electric vehicles. We went to the Peterson Automotive Museum to take a look back at history and look forward at the future of those gas-free vehicles. We're talking about electric cars this half hour, and if you thought that electric cars are a new phenomenon, well, you may be wrong about that. I mean, this car, it's a concept car from 2016. It's an electric hypercar. They say it's a 2016 Faraday future, but 101 years earlier, got that, 101 years earlier, a company came out with this car. This was a 1915 Detroit Electric Model 61 Brougham, and this guy right here is Leslie Kendall, and he's the chief historian of the Peterson Automotive Museum. First of all, I'm amazed by this vehicle you're standing next to.
Well, Al, I think you're in really good company, because a lot of people can't, first of all, they can't believe that electric cars have been around this long. And even longer than this, 1915 was actually late in electric car development, because they had been around since Robert Anderson in Scotland in about 1839 made the first electric car with dry cell batteries.
Whoa, so there was an electric car in 1839. Wow.
Wow-ish.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. So tell us about this exhibit that you got here at the Peterson. It's got a number of different electric vehicles.
Well, we like to show people, we know sort of where we're going, but we like to show people where we've been so that they can kind of extrapolate for themselves what they think the future might end up being. So we've got a Detroit Electric from the teens, a car that was very popular with the ladies of the day.
Pretty plush interior there.
A plush interior. It has, the seats are arranged in a conversational grouping.
Yeah, I can see that.
There's the back of the front seat actually is against the windshield of the car. So batteries in the front, batteries in the back, an electric motor underneath. And the ladies loved it because they didn't have to get out and crank it. They could just walk in, sit down, flip a switch, and take off.
1915, and this vehicle plugged into a power outlet.
It plugged into a kind of charger that it looks like it came from Frankenstein's workshop, but it nevertheless worked. And that's, you know, things evolve over time.
When we talk about these electric vehicles, and we're looking at some now, when we talk about these electric vehicles, it's always a political hot potato. Has it kind of always been that way? It feels to me like these early cars were just novelties. Am I right about that?
In a way, they were novelties, but there's a segment of the population called early adopters, and they will always want something, and they'll always get something before anybody else. And it was the same with the electric vehicles. Believe it or not, in the late 1800s, there was a steam car manufacturer in Los Angeles who said, oh, no, electricity is not where it's at. Gasoline power, not where it's at. Steam, that's where it's at. Because it was, in the day, understandable. You could perfect it. But eventually, they came to the point where electrics became so popular that in 1900, they outsold gasoline and steam-powered cars, at least for a time.
Now, we had gasoline crises here and there. Back in the 1970s, we had one there. When these things happen, is that when all of a sudden people start saying electric is the future?
They do tend to do that. People have very short memories because, you know, a month from now, if gasoline is, you know, at $1.99 a gallon, they're going to, you know, a lot of people will be back out buying SUVs and the, you know, the EVs on the dealer lots might be sitting there. But who knows?
You know, we see this situation now where we've got gas up over $5-6 a gallon. And this electric thing, it sounds like people are starting to think about it.
Well, it's making a lot of sense for a lot of people, including so many that the major auto manufacturers, people who once, you know, carried the standard for internal combustion engines, are now thinking electric. It has to be the future, because when you get right down to it, electric cars have very few moving parts. They're a lot more reliable. They're quieter. They're cleaner as an end user, and it's kind of like, and they're more powerful too. They got so much going for them.
We'll be back with more Fox 11 News in depth and all the things we have to be grateful for this Thanksgiving right after this. Don't go away. Welcome back to Fox 11 News in depth. We want to take a moment to thank the people who go out of their way to make so many lives better. We offer our appreciation to the helpers, the volunteers, and the innovators who elevate our human experience. Just one example we talked about this year, the volunteers who help foster kids negotiate the system with a group called CASA.
So CASA LA is a nonprofit organization within LA County that organizes community volunteers to advocate for both young children and their families within the child welfare system, which is a very overburdened system. So being able to come in and advocate for young people more at a one-on-one basis is a really key part of what we do.
A key part of what you do, I hear you saying that the system is overburdened. So I gather that's why this is necessary.
Yes. I think that one of the things that really comes up is that so many of our young people are part of this large system in which we have social workers, attorneys, judges, all of which have very extensive caseloads. And being able to have a CASA come on and be assigned to one youth and pay very direct attention to that one young person and identify their needs and supports is so vital in making sure that they are given the proper support and can thrive while they're in the system.
We were just looking at what I suppose is a public service announcement for your organization, and the smiles are heartwarming. They're big, they beam, they're broad. The volunteers, I'm sure they feel equally gratified. But who are these volunteers, and what do they go through to become part of the organization?
Yeah, our volunteers are incredible, incredible people. And one of the great things about volunteering with CASA is you don't need a background in social service or in the child welfare system. And that's because we do our best to provide a very extensive training process for our volunteers coming in. They go through a 40-hour training process that gives them a foundational knowledge of the child welfare system and different situations that their young person may be encountering. And once they are officially sworn in by a judge as a court-appointed special advocate, they are then matched with a master's level supervisor who continues to guide them as they are matched with and support a young person.
I'm just curious. I know that in a lot of situations you have training and you're specialized training even, but some of what you learn is really on the ground. It's not in the training session, right?
Oh, definitely. I mean, every young person, every case is so different. And so a lot of our CASAs really jump in and learn in the moment. But it's great that they know that they have the additional support, depending on what type of case they're connected to and what situations are coming up, to continue to learn as they go through it.
I understand that some of the things that these volunteers do is very elaborate and involves an awful lot. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Of course. So our volunteers can really support in a variety of different areas. We have CASAs help with identifying the most appropriate placements, CASAs helping with physical health, making sure young people are making it to their medical appointments, are, you know, taking the right medications for their mental health, and really working and collaborating with teams across the board to make sure that everyone is aware of and is on the same page as to what's in the child's best interest.
And then there's another kind of foster care, the furry kind. Guide Dogs of America uses foster volunteers as well to school their new puppies. And if you're interested, they always need more. Take a look. One of the biggest problems they have here at Guide Dogs of America may absolutely shock you. Take a look at these guys right here. The problem that they face is not enough volunteers to take home these ridiculously adorable puppies and take care of them for 1 year. I find that really hard to believe. It's just amazing because I want all of them. I've already told them that out here. I'll take every one of them. But of course, it requires a lot of dedication, a lot of commitment, and a lot of time. Dana Jenke is one of those who's done that. She's from Simi Valley. And Diana, thanks for joining us. You've been a volunteer for how many years?
About 11 years.
About 11 years. Tell me a little bit about that process.
The volunteering part, I started because I had a friend who was also doing it. And I thought, let me try to do this. I was a principal at a middle school at a time and started bringing a puppy with me because it was just something that I wanted to do, felt I could give back, and at the same time, raise a puppy.
Now, let's take a look at your puppy there. This is Jude.
Yes.
Hey, Jude. I remember that song. You remember that song?
I do.
Jude does not remember that song. How old is Jude?
Jude is 6 months old.
Tell me about Jude.
She is a puppy. She takes a work and commitment to be able to get her to do the things she does. Just sitting here like this, Jude, sit. To be able to do that for a long period of time is tough. So that's my job, is to prepare her for the bigger world.
Now, there's these bonding questions.
Yeah.
First, you get the puppy, then the puppy lives for a long time, and then the puppy's gone, and then the bonding. And the, how many puppies have you had?
She's number 9.
Oh, okay. So tell me how that bonding thing has been for you and the unbonding.
I've loved every single one of them, and there's a place in my heart for every single one. And of those, I have 4 that are working or in the process of being gotten ready for work, and then I have 4 that were career changed. One is a longtime pet of mine, and others have gone off to do wonderful things with other people.
Just give me a couple of ideas of things that you couldn't have done maybe without the dog along as a companion.
Oh, well, I mean, the dogs, you know, let's face it, I've been through some life things, and I've had these dogs by my side during some of this, and they get me through it because, you know, you can talk to dogs, and it's unconditional love and, you know, that kind of stuff. Being able to go out into the community with a dog, if I don't have a dog and I'm out in the community, sometimes it's like I feel empty, you know. Having a dog out in the community creates people having conversations with you and you being able to spread the good word about guide dogs.
And tell me about the training part.
For me, you know, you get support from the Canine Development Department here at Guide Dogs. They don't just hand you a puppy and say, see you in 18 months. They're here to support you. I'm also an area leader, so I help support other brand new puppy raisers by doing activities and going out and about and taking classes and helping them with struggles that they have, because we have struggles with them. They, you know, they're puppies. So you have to sometimes work through some of the tougher stuff.
What would you tell people who might like to do this, but maybe aren't sure?
I would say give it a try, because if you are at all interested in making a difference in somebody else's life as well as your own, then I would say give it a try. The support is there.
We'll be back with more of our good news over the past year right after this break. Be right back. Welcome back to Fox 11 News In Depth. And some of our best news this year involves medical and scientific advances so incredible they might seem unbelievable. But regenerative medicine, while still in its infancy, is bringing some remarkable healing to people who otherwise would have no other options. We talked with one of the pioneers of stem cell therapy and a patient in one of the early clinical trials about the potential of this therapy.
The stem cell is the one cell in a tissue or organ, let's say the blood-forming tissue, that when it divides to give rise to 2 daughter cells, at least one of them is a stem cell. That's called self-renewal. No other cell in the group of cells that it makes can self-renew. So it is the only cell that develops and maintains the system. The blood-forming stem cell is critical because not only was it the way to rescue people from radiation, but most of the chemo that's used to get rid of cancer or get rid of most of the cancer cells, your limitation is you are destroying also the blood-forming stem cells. So if you could take them out before their therapy and make sure they were pure, they didn't have any cancer cells with them, or any other dangerous cells with them, then you could reinfuse them right after they had what would be a lethal combination chemotherapy or radiotherapy. So that we thought, that's our first objective. Let's try to do it. And we turned to breast cancer because at the time, women with breast cancer that had spread beyond the breast and had gone to all parts of the body, you can't use surgery or radiotherapy now to get rid of it. So the only chance to get rid of it is very high dose combination chemotherapy, kill as many cells as you can. And we knew later in retrospect that we were taking 100 billion cancer cells down to less than 100,000.
It's mind-boggling. It really is when you think about all of this. But I want to turn to one of your patients who's up in Portland, Oregon right now, Ellen Perez. And Ellen, tell us about your case in the clinical trial, what you had, and how you are now.
Well, I was first diagnosed when I was 34, which, by the way, tomorrow I'll be 66. So it's quite a celebration for me. When I was, when it was 1996, I was diagnosed with stage four breast cancer. It had metastasized to my pelvic area and up and down my spine. So when I went to the oncologist, he had given me some information about the Stanford study that they were doing there, and left it up to me. And having the choice of either having the Stanford study of the high-dose chemotherapy or standard chemotherapy treatment was really important to me, because when you have cancer, you feel that you don't have control over your life much. And so to be able to make this choice for myself was very important. So I chose
the high-dose. When you think back, let me ask you, when you think back to Dr. Weissman finding something in a mouse, then translating that to humans, and then to ultimately breast cancer patients, and you think of how you are now and how you were back when you were much younger, what is your sense of this entire technology?
It's amazing. It is just unbelievable. And I am so grateful to the scientists and the doctors that have put so much work into this to be able to purify your stem cells and put them back into you to make the possibility of curing you, which happened to me, is unbelievable. And I can't say enough how much I am grateful for this study, for Dr. Weissman and his work that he's done, because I would not be here.
We'll be back with more Fox 11 News In Depth right after this. That's it for this week's Fox 11 News In Depth. Thanks for joining us, everyone. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time. And just a big thank you from all of us to all of you for sharing this year with us. And we'll leave you with these images as we go. As mankind has always looked to the stars with awe and wonder, so do we. And even more powerfully now with the launch of the James Webb Space Telescope. Enjoy the wonder, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
James Webb begins a voyage back to the birth of the universe.
And so there's that question we often ask in news. Why should we be concerned? Why should we care? Why should we feel good about this? Why?
I mean, you know, at the end of the day, we want to understand where we come from, what we're made of, how unique we are in the universe. Personally, something I'm interested in is trying to find Earth 2.0. Are we alone in the universe? And GWST will be able to start making footsteps towards answering that question.